You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm here today with the great Israeli novelist, Amos Oz. His most recent book is Panther in the Basement, published by Harkett Brace and Company. Among his more recent books are Don't Call It Night, FEMA, To Know a Woman, Black Box, and to go back to the beginning, of course, My Michael, Elsewhere Perhaps, Touch the Water, Touch the Wind. Now, FEMA is a young person's story, and in fact, you say in it that everything has two sides except a shadow. And it seems to me that because this book is the story of a very young person who has not yet learned the two sides of everything, it's a more simple account than you usually find in an Amos Oz novel.
Well, it aims at a certain simplicity. Perhaps I should define it as a second simplicity, not below but beyond complexity. It's about a little boy who assumes that everything has two sides except for a shadow, but eventually in the course of this short novel he discovers that shadows too cast shadows.
He says, in fact, that some of his knowledge when he was a boy, because now he's grown up and writing this book, came to him in the form of a shadow, that he would know things before he knew them. And it seems, in a sense, that this book is written within that shadow, the place before you know what is actually happening. And there's a good deal of reconstruction that a reader does after the book to find out what it is that Profi, who is the boy, the nickname of the boy, what it is that Profi now knows.
It's a great deal about premonitions, and not all the premonitions are eventually in the course of the novel exposed or opened to the light. Some things do remain shady. This boy grows up in a world full of secrets, heavily censored. Both his parents are survivors of the Nazi extermination of the Jews, and they never talk about it. Both of them are in panic about what might happen to the Jews in Jerusalem in a year or two when the British goes out, but they never talk about it. So he can sense the fear, the apprehension, the subterranean longings of his parents and the neighbors and the entire neighborhood to the Europe which they had left behind or to the Europe that kicked them out. The entire unrequited love of that generation with Europe is hushed and censored. And the boy can sense it and guess it as a shadow of a shadow.
There are certain words that he learns not to say around his mother. You name them, and they're words that will remind her of a grander life in Europe. And part of the thematic of the novel set in this period of time, the British occupation, and you've written quite a few of them, is on the one hand waiting, and on the other hand the deprivation of a life that these pioneers no longer know.
Well, they have lost not their memory, but their inner ability to share memories, even with each other. They don't talk about their memories. And at the same time, the whole of Jerusalem lives under a constant cloud of fear which is not to be discussed. When I was a young kid, my parents used to say to me that one day, perhaps not in their lifetime, but in mine, Jerusalem will evolve into a real city. It took me many years to find out that when they mentioned a real city, they meant a city with a river across and bridges and thick forests round about. To me, Jerusalem was the only real place I knew, but their kind of reality, their subdued longings and fears were censored.
Now, you have anticipated, or there's been a premonition of Profi in at least two books, in a novel for children, Sumchi, in two of the three stories in The Hill of Evil Counsel. And I wanted to ask you what causes you to recur, not to that situation, but to this boy?
Probably because I have not quite decoded and deciphered that boy. He is still very much on my mind, and I need to get back to him from different angles. I don't know that even now with Panther, I am through with him. There is a lot more about this boy which still intrigues me. The kind of coincidence between his own formative years and the formative years of Jewish Jerusalem. The birth of his own loneliness and the birth of the State of Israel. Very different events. The realization, almost the portrait of an artist as a young man in him, and the deep, almost hysterical, collective experience of the time. Everybody belonged while this boy was losing some of his sense of belonging. He is called a traitor by some in this novel. And moreover, he does feel like a traitor. And worse than that, he is caught in a cycle of betrayals. Whatever he will do, or refuse to do, or refrain from doing, he will be unloyal to someone or to something. It's a no-win game. It's a catch-22 for him.
He comes to understand when he's talking to the Sergeant Dunlap, the British gentleman who loves Hebrews and may, unfortunately, at least in some people's eyes, love children. This policeman accountant helps him understand that in the Bible, all of the figures that he cares about are in fact betrayers, from David and Saul on, that betrayal, in a certain sense, is part of nobility.
Well, change. You know, anyone who changes is a traitor in the eyes of those who cannot change, or would not change, or unable to even conceive what change is. They regard the ones who change as traitors. And this boy changes in the few weeks, the span of the novel, he changes a great deal. He discovers that the enemy, Sergeant Dunlop, the representative of evil on earth, the oppressor, the British, he is someone with whom he can share his love for language and his love for words. He's most subversive of all his many loves. And between him and Sergeant Dunlop, there is almost the immediate kinship, the realization that the two of them are birds of a feather.
It's interesting because when he's brought before the council of the private underground he's formed, what is it, Freedom or Death, FOD, his friend Ben-Hur tells him that his sin is not having accepted crackers and lemonade from the sergeant, not even their discussions together. He's told, you love the enemy.
That's the worst of all sins. And of course, the court martial and the accuser is absolutely right. The charges are right. Hence, Prof is terrible, bewilderment and fear and guilt and loneliness. He is not guilty of selling information to the enemy. He is not guilty of revealing the secrets of the make-believe childish underground to the enemy. But he is guilty of loving the enemy, and he cannot help it.
Well, you know, in the world of things that have two sides, it's quite clear that you, as a novelist, to bring a multi-sided perspective to every situation, really, that you handle, sometimes quite terrifyingly so. When I read your last novel, Don't Call It Night, a novel which alternates between chapters of a woman, the older man she lives with, and occasionally an omniscient narrator, one sees so wonderfully the sides that the other cannot see. So it seems as if a novelist's obligation is to love the enemy or to decide that there is no enemy.
In other words, to be a traitor one way or another, to travel across the street and peek at your own window, see what your own room, what your own family, what your own self looks like as viewed from the enemy, from the window of the enemy across the street.
Have you been accused yourself of being a traitor?
Many times in my life, just like the narrator of Panther in the Basement. I've been called a traitor many times in my life, and personally I regard this particular epitaph as a decoration. which I wear proudly on the inner side of my lapel.
Now, there seem to be two kinds of dangerous people. There are people like Ben-Hur who are described as being thirsty, and they are the leopards. But somehow the panthers seem to be in a more indeterminate situation. Can you describe that?
Well, Ben-Hur, the leopard, is perpetually thirsty because the only thing that can both excite him and make him move is the need to dominate and to manipulate. It's not the need to manipulate someone or to dominate something. It's the perpetual urge, thirst for a state of domination. This is unquenchable, and what the narrator, Prophy, regards as deadly is his own fascination with such characters, his own attraction to such characters. As for the panther is elusive, attractive from a certain distance, a predator, no doubt, in some eyes, a dancer, a poet, a burning bright, if you wish. So he is a different thing to different people. He's a different thing to Yardena, with whom he is hopelessly in love. She's 20, he's 12 and a quarter. This is the most tragic of all love relationships, harder than Romeo and Juliet. There is no hope for a 12 and a quarter year old boy loving a 20 year old woman. So he is a different being to different people. And so much so that he is in perpetual quest for his own self. He is so good at putting himself under other people's skins or inside their shoes that he is seized by doubts about who really he is, like a secret agent who, after many years, might lose his own identity.
You've mentioned that your own literary influences were, in a sense, formed by your parents. That is to say, they had a preference for Russian fiction and for Jewish fiction. And I sense that the first time you come on these materials in the Hill of Evil Counsel, in the first story, you tell this almost as a Tolstoyan narrative. There's a ball, there's an infidelity, there's a betrayal. In the second story in the book, suddenly we're in a kind of Chekhov territory where everyone, whenever they get the chance, is sighing and talking about the future, the hopeless future of Chekhov. And the third story, Mr. Levi, is a Dostoevskian, internal, self-examining, lost person. It seems to me that in Sunchi and Panther in the Basement, you are trying to extract these materials from under the cover of the other writers who might have told the story. This time it is going to be your own.
Well, if I have done the same time in my life, the same material, through a Tolstoyan angle, Dostoevskian angle, Chekhovian angle, maybe it's a time for a playful Gogolian one.
Of course. So this is, in a sense, why there are little stories, like the story of the next-door neighbor and the flute that she brings back, that the narrator tells us he's not going to tell right now. It belongs in its own book. This is the person who slips between the cracks in Gogol.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, this is more playful than my other stories set in the 40s. This Panther is the most playful one, and in some ways perhaps the most complex one. I think Panther in the Basement, of all the stories I have set in the 40s, in Jerusalem of the 40s, all the stories which are related to my early years and my teen years, this one is the most light-hearted one, although it's not a simple tale. But it takes Prophy from the beginning of the novel, where the boy is a little fanatic, a brainwashed 12-year-old, an obsessive newspaper reader, a conformist who buys all the ideological and chauvinistic slogans of parents and neighbors and newspapers and Bible teacher, and in a span of a very few weeks, he changes into a skeptic, a sober skeptic, who has compassion for everybody, for all sides in this conflict, who can even forgive, well, forgiving the British is nothing, coming to terms in his mind and in his heart with the Arabs is nothing. He can come to terms with his own father up to a point. He can feel for his father's own misery and unhappiness. Now, this is traveling a very long way in a short span of time and in a short novel. It's one of the most concentrated works I'd ever done. I should tell you, although I'm answering a question you didn't ask, but I'm a notorious digressor. In the initial drafts, Panther in the Basement was a much, much longer book. And there was a long struggle on my part to make it short and poignant and lean and with no extra weight. I can't remember tightening up any previous novel as cruelly as I did with this one. I wanted it really to be minimalistic.
For those who have just tuned in, I'm speaking to Amos Oz about his most recent novel, Panther in the Basement. This is Michael Silverblatt on Bookworm. I see what you mean, and yet, thank goodness, the tightening up allows for a really delicious excursion into the love that the boy feels for his father's library, which is imagined in all sorts of ways. Some of the books are very important army officials, their gold spines decorated as the colonels and generals are with medals. He knows, as any bookworm would, the smell of library paste and the sour smells of paper and the smell of the rot of books. And this, you see, made me weep. It seemed to be one of the beautiful places where one senses what this boy has to grow up to be.
Well, thank you, Michael. These are very moving words and very precious to me. In fact, Panther in the Basement is, of course, autobiographical, though not confessional. But I don't mind telling you right away that the bit about the library is autobiographical and confessional. For me, my father's library, which was not much bigger than this little studio here, but for me, this was the entire universe. It had galaxies and planets and meteorites and black holes, even though at that time we didn't know about black holes. And there was everything there. There were distant shelves in foreign languages which I couldn't even decode the bindings. It was an entire universe. Moreover, it was a very sensual universe. Books are sensual. I used to smell them, to touch them, to feel them. I used to peek into the flavory dark space between the cloth binding and the book's back, like peeking under a girl's skirt. It was attractive, it was mysterious, it was fascinating and sensual. And this bit about the library is, in some ways, the crux of the entire book.
Now tell me, although your specialty, in a sense, as a novelist, has been a certain kind of good but unremarkable male, usually husband figure, he's certainly there in To Know a Woman. He was introduced in My Michael. It does not seem to be the case that Profi will grow up into such a one. I was wondering, of your other heroes, who is Profi most like as he grows up?
Well, with a slight twist, he might grow up into a Fema, namely the 55 or 50-year-old intellectual who remains childish, curious, open-minded, a feeler and a toucher whose finger, he can't keep his fingers to himself all his life. Yes, I think this Profi is in some ways related to middle-age Fema in the novel which bears Fema's name.
When I read recently Black Box and To Know a Woman and Don't Call It Night, these are portraits of very different kinds of marriages, unions between men and women. And when I came to read Black Box, I was riveted by what had become at this point, not what I'd known before in your work, the problems engendered by passivity and desire, but rather a poisonousness of people who want too much. It's, in a sense, your hungriest novel and the one with the greatest density of action. I mean, I turn the pages almost breathlessly, as opposed to in To Know a Woman, which is an anti-spy novel in which the character mm-hmm. is releasing himself into greater and greater and greater acceptance and or passivity. So I wondered about those states of gentleness and intensification that seem to hold different novels together in sets.
Well, Black Box, perhaps more than any other one of my novels, is openly about fanatics and fanaticism. It's a study in fanaticism. Everyone in Black Box is a fanatic of a different color, not necessarily a religious fundamentalist or a chauvinist zealot. There are many kinds of fanatics. They come in many brands. Do I know the anti-smokers who will burn you alive for lighting a cigarette, or the vegetarians who will eat you alive for eating meat? So Black Box was openly about screamy fanatics. There is latent fanaticism in my other books as well. There is latent fanaticism in Panther in the Basement, and the boy is struggling with it, coping with it, trying to define himself within it without catching it. But to me, the most fascinating thing that the novel can do, and this is why I'm so committed to this literary form, I find there is one thing that the novel can do and the short story cannot. Novel can do and the poem cannot. The drama cannot. And this is reveal the slight, microscopic, invisible trajectory deviation, which eventually take an entire life off course. Not the sudden accident, not the dramatic explosion, not the Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf night, not the Big Bang. The slight trajectory deviation, which can only be described on the long span of a seemingly relaxed and peaceful novel dealing with kitchen routine and bedroom routine and living room routine and bathroom routine. That's where this slight trajectory deviation can be conceived and revealed.
The slight deviations seem to be revealed as well in what is a constant in all of these novels. Although here and there a professor is teaching at the University of London or at an American university, these books all take place in Israel. Some of it is a night Israel. Some of it is an Israel of caves and secret passageways. Some of it is an Israel seen from balconies to the hills in the distance. But always an enormous faithfulness. However much you might love the enemy, there is always the intimacy of Israel in these works. But how does she change from work to work?
Well, in the first place, I ought to tell you what I'm sure you know already. I love Israel even at times when I don't like it. I love it even at times when I cannot stand it. It changes before my eyes. Being an Israeli of my age is presumably the equivalent of being a 326-year-old American. I have seen the Boston Tea Party with my own eyes. Essentially, it's about a dream come true. Now, it's in the nature of fulfilled dreams to taste sour. There is a touch of disappointment in any fulfillment. This is true of planting a garden, writing a novel, living out a sexual fantasy, or building a nation. The only way to keep a dream rosy and intact is never to try to live it out. Now, I have seen Israel moving from a flawless conglomeration of dreams and fantasies and master plans and hopes and aspirations and desires into very flawed realities. And I have seen it not with shattering disappointment, not with anger, but almost with compassion. It's like watching someone you love dearly slowly aging and slowly revealing or discovering that he or she are not going to fulfill all their dreams.
Mm. It's so marvelous to see within the same book, as in Panther in the Basement, two parents who differently, for the father, the world has been replaced by his library. For the mother, she has to lie down frequently, and in a sense, Israel is insufficient for her. For the boy, it's all he's ever known, and so it fills him with a kind of mystery that one senses he will grow up exploring. many of the boys in your work want telescopes, not just to peep across at neighboring girls, but there's almost a sense that the link between the cosmos and the place where you are is as short as a tiny bit of equipment. It seems as if this is all they need to get to the stars.
Yes, the stars are very close. Close because our parents came from there. They never admitted it, but they came from a different planet or even a different galaxy. You see, both my parents were, in a sense, exiles in Israel. They never admitted it. They were committed Zionists. They loved the country. They were devoted to it. They were willing to stand for it and, if necessary, to fight for it. And yet something about the place, the shade of color, the light, the climate, the atmosphere, made them feel perpetually homesick to Europe, and I think they never discussed it between themselves. But the boy that I was must have sensed it and is constantly journeying back on the road they had taken, not in order to repair the irreparable, but in order to understand that which had been kept secret from me.
Now tell me, one senses always, you know, Profi goes in the library from the specifics of battle to the black holes and the spiraling galaxies, and frequently in these books, when people turn on the television set, a documentary about the origins of the universe is always on, no matter when they turn on the television. It seems to be the staple of Israeli documentary. But I wanted to ask you about the relation between the particular and the universal in your work.
Well, I'll give you a universal, not a particular answer. I think in every work of literature that I ever admired, there is this mysterious formula: the more local, the more provincial, the more parochial, the more universal it may become. Mind you, not the more international, not the more cosmopolitan, but the more universal. This is the magic of the books I love. They take me into faraway places where I'd never been, far in time or far in space or both. They take me into cultures that I never studied, and they make me feel not just at home in the sense of visiting a living room, but at home in the sense of penetrating a bedroom of a very different family or a very different way of life. So I suppose, if I'm lucky, my books may do the same. The more Israeli they are, the more local, the more specific and even parochial, the more they stand a chance to touch a chord of familiarity, even intimacy, in the heart of faraway readers.
I've been speaking to Amos Oz, the author most recently of Panther in the Basement, published by Harkett Brace. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in
bunch. Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.